Matters, a one-hour programme that shares all things psychology. Mind Matters will host a variety of guests, from neuropsychologists and prison psychologists to those with lived experience of mental health challenges. We aim to share knowledge and experience, encourage interesting dialogue and reduce stigma. Join us on Monday evenings from 6 to 7pm on 3CR 855am. And welcome to this week's episode of Mind Matters on 3CR 855am, 3CR digital and online at 3cr.org.au. My name is Kirsty and I'll be your host today. Today I'm joined in the studio by Paulina Marta, who has worked as a psychologist and clinician in a maximum security men's prison. She currently works as a psychologist and case manager at an adolescent inpatient unit. Thank you for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
So I thought we could begin by discussing your work in the prison system. Are you able to give us a brief description of your role in the prison and your day-to-day activities?
Sure. So in the prison, I worked with violent offenders mostly, and sometimes with general offenders. So men who had committed crimes to do with aggression, but also things like theft and burglary. My role was to work with them in a counselling capacity when they were distressed, as well as running group programs for kind of to help them not to reoffend.
Yeah.
And then I guess the other thing that we did was help guys who were locked up 23 hours a day, just checking in to see that they were okay.
Yeah.
Yep.
How did you get into working in a prison?
I kind of fell into the work, so it was a bit strange. I guess I was finishing off at uni and just started applying for jobs, and it popped up and I thought, why not? I guess I never thought they'd take me straight out of uni, but they did.
Yeah. So was this when you'd finished your honours or?
My master's. Yeah. So I did a 5+1 pathway in psychology, which is like it was called a Master of Professional Psychology. So you can specialise in psychology, but I just did a general degree.
Okay. Mm. Mm. And so you ran offending behaviour programmes with violent offenders. Can you give us an example of a programme that you ran and how you developed it? Like, did you develop them or you just implemented?
I mostly just implemented them. So they're developed by Corrections Victoria.
Yeah.
And they're run throughout the state. We have a bit of scope to individualise them depending who we're working with, but otherwise it's mostly manualised programmes.
Okay. And what were the goals of the programmes that you implemented?
I guess for the violence risk programmes, the general goal is to decrease someone's risk of violent reoffending. So
yeah.
I guess, you know, a lot of these men in maximum security prisons have got a long history of doing aggressive things. And I guess the very general goal of the program is to figure out, you know, why they do that and then how we can work on decreasing that and maybe replacing those behaviours with something a little bit more healthy.
Yeah.
Mm.
And how long did the programs usually last for?
It depended on how risky the men were. So we had like categories of the men. So if someone was maybe only in prison once or had done an offence that maybe wasn't so violent, they might be at low risk.
Yeah.
Or they could be at moderate risk or at high risk. And depending on their risk, they'd be in a different program, and the high risk offenders were in the longest programs.
Okay.
There was the most to work on, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you provided brief counselling to the inmates who were distressed. Did you find that they responded well to therapy? Like, did they want to open up and talk to you, or did you kind of?
Well, I think in that population, it was a bit hard because a lot of the men had been kind of taught that it wasn't strong or wasn't brave to talk about your feelings. And so they'd only really see me at their breaking point. And I guess at that point, you know, they might be able to talk, or they might just simply start crying, and some of them could just say, thanks for, you know, just giving me the opportunity to let that out, because I guess they have nowhere safe to do that in the prison.
Yeah. And that would have been a big thing for them, I'm sure, to, like, cry in front of someone.
Yeah.
If they find it difficult to just talk about their emotions, then breaking down would be...
Definitely. Yeah.
How did you stay motivated when working with people with complex issues?
I guess I love working with people with complex issues. Yeah. I think the more complex someone is, the more interesting they are, really.
Yeah.
And I think often the people with the most complex issues are the ones that kind of need help the most. So it's motivating as well in that way.
Mm.
Yeah.
Did you always want to do psychology? Like, could you always see yourself doing a helping profession?
Well, when I was in high school, I thought maybe I'd be a nurse. So that's a helping profession. And then I guess I tried that and realised that it involved a lot of gross things. I had to, So I did work experience and had to change someone's colonoscopy bag. So
yeah.
I guess that put me off a little bit. And I thought, what else can I do to help people that doesn't involve something so graphic? And that led me to psych.
So did you go to uni to and study nursing?
I didn't, no. So I basically, after I think it was year 10 work experience, I decided maybe nursing wasn't for me, and then did psychology in VCE and kept going with it.
Okay. Obviously things, what I imagine, can get quite intense like during your role as a psychologist. What strategies did you put in place to maintain a cool and collected demeanour? Did you have specific things you'd implement, like breathing for 10 seconds or...?
I don't think I have anything specific, really.
Yeah.
I think as a psychologist, you do have to be composed, but it's kind of this fine balance of also being real, because you need to show the client that, you know, you are there to empathise and you are real. And I guess, you know, although you have to be strong for them... it's definitely a fine balance, I think.
Yeah. Do you ever disclose things about yourself to try to make yourself relatable? Because it is a bit of an odd dynamic.
Like, it is.
Where one person is disclosing thoughts and feelings and emotions, and you feel like you know nothing about the other person.
I think that's... it's rare that I will disclose something. If it is, it's something that needs to be very relevant to the client. And I guess I have to second guess myself that it's not for my own needs that I'm disclosing something. So I guess there's a lot of thinking that goes behind it before I say something.
Where do you think you would disclose something for your own needs?
I guess it's just something that we're taught at university, that it's just easy to, you know, slip with your boundaries. And, you know, if things are getting quite emotional in the room, that you might, as, you know, your kind of human need to comfort someone or to be relatable or something like that might come out. And in that moment you might need to kind of have a think about whether that's actually going to be helpful for the client or whether it's more for your own needs to make yourself feel better that you're going to act in a certain way.
Yeah. So what's an example of something that you have disclosed that you thought would benefit them or was like very relatable, specific to the situation?
Gosh, I can't think of anything right now. Maybe something more... general, for example, like if someone's going through a breakup, I might kind of generally relate that to, you know, my own situation. You know, I've kind of gone through that before and, you know, in that kind of way. So in that way, I guess you can try and help normalise the person's experience. Like, you know, so they think, oh, well, everyone goes through breakups and everyone gets through it. And I guess in that way it can be helpful to disclose something personal.
How do you think the guys would have described you?
I don't know. It's very funny in prison because they all refer to women as miss. Mm. So I almost felt like a school teacher or something. But I think it's a sign of respect, which is nice.
Because that's the main thing that I've been thinking of, that, like, do you get treated with respect, or because you're, like, a young, attractive, like, blonde psychologist, like, do they kind of, I don't know, treat you differently?
Right at the start, I think they definitely know that you're new.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of testing.
Yeah.
So, you know, the men, it's almost like high school or something. Like, the guys will kind of congregate in a group and one of them will yell something out,
yeah,
like something silly, and then they'll all giggle and then they'll kind of look at you to see what your response is. And I think at the start, because they can see that you're new and you're nervous and it's like a little bit of a game as well. And then over time, as they kind of see you around and get to know who you are and that kind of thing, and I think the men that you do come in contact with become quite protective of, you know, someone they respect, then if someone does say something, say if, you know, someone makes an inappropriate comment, then often maybe another man will kind of step in and say, come on, mate, like, pull your head in, or that kind of thing. So definitely at the start it's a difficult kind of adjustment.
Yeah.
But over time I think it gets a lot easier as people get to know you and you become more of a familiar face in the environment.
So at the beginning, what kind of things would you do? Like, when comments were kind of hollered, would you say something or would you ignore it? Or what was your approach to that?
Mostly I'd try and ignore it.
Yeah.
I have to say there were a few times where I did respond.
Yeah.
And I like to think it was kind of in a measured way, so that, I guess, just to show that, you know, it's not respectful to speak like that and you can't get away with that.
Yeah.
And that was mostly if, I guess, it was someone that I could see was quite close to me.
Mm.
You know, if it's someone hollering from the other end of the yard, I'm not going to holler back
at them,
because I think that's kind of not what they want in a way. So
yeah,
kind of depends on the situation.
In your opinion, why do you think most people end up in prison?
I think most, if not all, of the men that I came into contact with had some sort of trauma, at least one in their history. Often their childhoods were really, really difficult. A lot of the time their caregivers or their parents or whoever was meant to be caring for them basically was not. Either, you know, being neglectful or actually, you know, abusive. So, there were some pretty horrible kind of stories. Like, there was a man who, you know, when he was 11, his father kind of taught him to go and score heroin for him.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then this guy was kind of taught, you know, to inject by his father when he was 11. And that was, you know, his reward. And they would kind of do burglaries together to pay for the habit. And it was just like, you think, you know, how can someone not fall into a life of crime if that's what they're taught from, you know, that's like grade 5, grade 6. So a lot of pretty intense childhoods.
Yeah.
Mm.
And what about the guys that didn't have childhood trauma? Because there's obviously guys in prison that didn't have any trauma. What do you think causes their behaviour?
I honestly can't think of any guy that I came in contact with who had no trauma.
So that's a big one then.
Yeah. I'm trying to think back and I can't think of one that hadn't had something happen to them that was really horrific.
Yeah. You've been listening to Mind Matters on 3CR 855 AM. We are talking to Paulina Marta about her experience as a prison psychologist. Join us after this short song break for more interesting discussions.
sparring is training, chain snatching the slaves.
The song that you were just listening to is called Israel by Chance the Rapper featuring No Name. This is Mind Matters on 3CR, and we're currently talking to Paulina Marta about her experience as a prison psychologist. What are some common issues or topics you explored with inmates in therapy? Did they discuss the childhood trauma a lot, or...?
I guess trauma is something that's really difficult to work with. Mm. It's not always helpful to bring it up and directly talk about it. Sometimes it can be, but other times it can re-traumatise someone. I guess when someone's gone through a trauma, they build up a lot of defences around that. Some of them might be helpful and some of them might be unhelpful.
Yeah.
But it's a bit hard to judge, I guess, when to, you know, confront trauma.
Mm.
The things we'd really deal with were the issues that came up around it. So I guess, you know, someone might have formed a really negative view of the world or negative view of themselves. And so we'd deal with that and try and change that rather than kind of talking about specific incidents that might have happened.
Yeah. Mm. Did you work with any guys serving a life sentence? And if so, how did you help them come to terms with their situation?
I did come in contact with a few guys that were serving a life sentence. And it's interesting because I think at various different points of their sentence, people are quite different. So, you know, the guys that I'd seen who had been served with a life sentence and had been, you know, in prison for 10 years already, they had long accepted, you know, what had happened, and they were kind of really respected in the prison environment. And, you know, they kind of were the guys who had their own cells and, you know, had the run of the place and, you know, everyone respected them. So in a way they, you know, had adapted to their environment. So there was one man that I was working with who had expected to get a much lighter sentence.
Mm.
And when he found out that, you know, he had to be in prison for quite a long time, that was a huge shock to him. And I think, you know, working with him was really hard because I felt his sadness a lot. And there was a lot of, I guess, transference, where I think I'd gone through the whole journey with this man of kind of his hope and then, you know, that real journey of grief that he had to go through. And I think, you know, that's really, really hard.
Yeah, that would be hard. So I reckon a lot of people who go into psychology obviously have a lot of empathy. So they would feel people's emotions and people's pain a lot. So how do you keep it separate? Like how do you go home at the end of the day and not ruminate and feel it?
Yeah. I think it's something that comes with practice. At the start, it's really, really hard not to kind of get really invested in the people you work with. But I think over time, and it must be how we adapt to things. I guess your brain just kind of adjusts to being, you know, a little bit more maybe protected. There are still some cases, and I guess, you know, you have to be really aware of your own triggers. You learn that, I guess, some things specifically might be really difficult, particularly hard to kind of let go of or separate from. But I think, yeah, that's why it's so interesting, because you just learn so much about yourself over time as well. And I guess maybe, you know, you can protect yourself a little bit in that if you know that a client's got a certain issue or a certain kind of story that you're really, really sensitive to, then you might maybe not even start work with them or refer them to another psychologist.
So what are some skills and ways of thinking that you've developed through your professional life that have transferred to your personal life? Like, do you find you're able to detach more easily, or...?
Yeah, potentially I can look at situations a bit more holistically. So rather than kind of getting really emotionally driven, I guess, maybe being able to step back and logically consider how things are fitting into place. Or I think especially for me, I've noticed if, you know, someone does something that I disagree with, or does something that I find to be maybe hurtful or wrong, I guess, I'm more able to maybe kind of coolly consider it from their perspective. So maybe it is what you said about maybe detaching a little bit to be able to see the wider picture.
What's the most insightful thing an inmate has shared with you?
Gosh,
any little like words of wisdom or any stories that have really like stayed with you or inspired you?
It's not really inspirational, but it stayed with me because I just, you know, what struck me about prison and I guess humans is that they can adapt to any situation and literally will think of really crazy new ideas in an environment where it's really hard to kind of survive. And this is like not inspirational, but I was kind of taken aback by it. So one of the men told me this story about how one of his friends had like made a pouch in his mouth. So what he'd done is he'd used, I think, a razor blade to cut a little pouch and then put a razor blade inside there so that his skin didn't seal up, so that he had a perfect little pouch to, you know, smuggle various things in. But I was just like, who could even think like that? And just, some of those stories that they had are just, just too much.
You can't make that stuff up.
Exactly.
So is there a clear hierarchy in the prison?
I would say so.
You see it on TV and movies, like the top dogs and the ones that are on the bottom of the ladder. Like, is that a real thing?
To an extent, So I guess a lot of those guys who are there for, you know, life sentences, for example, they pretty much rise to the top of the hierarchy. And, you know, men who kind of don't maybe assert themselves as much or are more in the background and keep to themselves might be a bit lower down in that hierarchy.
Okay. I'll take this opportunity now to go on another short little break. You're listening to Mind Matters on 3CR 855 AM, and we've been talking to Paulina Marta on her experience as a prison psychologist. See you in a bit. We're just listening to Shea Butter Baby by J. Cole and Ari Lennox. You're currently listening to Mind Matters on 3CR 855 AM, and we're talking to Paulina Marta about her experience as a prison psychologist and the work that she's currently doing now. Can you describe the role that you're now currently engaged in?
Sure. So I work in an adolescent psychiatric ward. So with people from 12 to 18, and I guess most of their issues are quite, well, they're there for pretty acute, you know, reasons. So either going through maybe a manic episode or psychosis, or often after a suicide attempt.
Mm.
So really our job is, you know, to keep them safe. That's like the primary thing we do, but also just to make sure that they're going to be okay when they leave.
Yeah.
So most of it is just about assessment. So assessing, you know, are they okay? What do they need? What might be wrong? Because sometimes, especially if they're young, they might not have really been in contact with any mental health services before. And then what's the best way forward in terms of treatment?
Mm. How did you make the transition from working like in a men's prison to working with adolescents?
Well, at the prison, I guess I really enjoyed working with the younger guys. I found that there was a lot more hope. There was a lot more, I guess, malleability to them. They were easier to work with in a sense. I think a lot of the adults had already formed their views, and, you know, it's really hard to help someone change if, one, they don't want to. Or two, it's just been so long living in a certain way that they're kind of not able to. So I thought, you know, why don't I try working with young people? And because, like, I do like working with people with complex issues. I thought working in a psychiatric ward would be really interesting.
So how long were you working in the prison for?
About 2 years.
Okay, and you've been in this current role for how long?
Just over a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
What are the main differences in working with adolescents compared to adult male offenders? Because there's obviously that malleability factor.
There's that. I think adolescents are, it's a really interesting kind of age because it's like they really, really want to be individuals and really want to be themselves, but they're also so dependent on others still. So it's like this fight between those two things with adolescents. So they really kind of want your help, but they're too desperate. Like they're too kind of proud and desperate to be themselves to ask for that help. So it's kind of like, you know, someone sitting in the room with you, and you're being, you know, saying, I'm here to help you. And they're like, fuck off, but they won't leave the room. Whereas the adult men or adults in general, I think, might be sometimes more accepting of that help, but perhaps too stuck or more stuck. So it might be more difficult to change things.
Which group do you find more challenging?
I think there's challenges with both groups and they're different. The biggest challenge working with adolescents is their parents. Hands down.
Really?
Yeah, definitely. Managing that family system and the relationships between, you know, all the different family members. And if often people have different agendas, different understandings of what's going on. I guess part of working with adolescents, you know, you have to work with their families as well. And sometimes it's hard to come to a mutual understanding and agreement. So it can get pretty hostile sometimes.
So what are the main issues with the families or the parents? Is it that they are in denial as to the problems that their child is facing or that they think they know what's best for them?
Yeah, both of those things. So it could be that they're in denial, for example. You know, it could be that something that occurred in the child's past and in the parents' past might have been traumatic for the child and the parent does not want to think about that because it's too scary or, you know, it means it might be their fault and it's too scary to think about that. So that can get in the way, or maybe that, you know, they prefer to think that their child is naughty or, you know, out to get them rather than unwell. Yeah, that happens a lot, I guess, with kids as well who have autism and their parents really just don't want them to. So they might kind of make, you know, form this narrative that their child is just a naughty child that, you know, just needs some discipline and then everything will be fine. So, yeah, it can be pretty hard to change some of those narratives with the parents.
So what are the main psychiatric, emotional and behavioural difficulties that you face in the inpatient unit?
So I think the biggest one, I guess, is risky behaviour in terms of harming others and harming themselves. So someone, you know, having urges to self-harm or to end their life is a really, really big one. Less often people who have urges to harm others, or otherwise people who are very unwell and might kind of come to some kind of harm by accident. So, you know, because they're maybe not of sound mind, they might run away somewhere and get lost or those kind of behaviours. So I guess running away is another behaviour that we have to be a bit careful of.
Do you use seclusion as a method of controlling challenging behaviour?
That's an interesting one. We do have a seclusion room. The way the ward is set out, it's got two sections. The high dependency section and the low dependency section. And the high dependency section only has several rooms. And if someone comes in who I guess we've never heard of or we've never come into contact with, often they'll go into the high dependency side. And that's, I guess it's almost a bit of a form of seclusion. But as soon as we can be sure that they're going to be safe and that, you know, they can be okay in the low dependency side, then we'll transition that person to be there. In terms of the actual seclusion room, it's very rarely used. Very rarely. And it just, again, all comes back to that risk. Like if someone is so out of control that they're going to hurt someone else or they're going to hurt themselves, then that's when the seclusion room will be used.
And what are the main difference between the high and low dependency areas?
The high dependency area is low stimulus. So there's not much in there. Everything is soft, like soft chairs. just, I guess, the things that are needed. If someone's really unwell or at risk, to keep them safe, it's kind of best to limit anything that they might hurt themselves with. But it's also, if, you know, their brain is working at 100 miles a minute, it can be a lot more soothing to be in an environment that's very simplistic. So that's why that's set up in that way.
You're listening to Mind Matters on 3CR 855 AM, a show about all things psychology. Join us after this short break. The song that was just playing was River by Leon Bridges. You're listening to Mind Matters on 3CR 855 AM, and we're talking to Paulina Marta, who works in an adolescent psychiatric unit. So we spoke before about parents in therapy. So how involved are the parents?
The The parents are very involved,
yeah,
most of the time.
Like on a daily basis or?
Well, it depends on the parents, actually.
Yeah.
Most parents will, you know, want to be checking in every day and be very involved. Mm. However, I guess, you know, there are a lot of parents who unfortunately, you know, have a lot of their own issues.
Mm-hmm.
And they might kind of need a bit of respite. So, you know, when their child is in hospital, they might use it as an opportunity to maybe distance themselves a little bit. And we do actually have a lot of situations where parents just give up and say, I can't do this anymore. And then, you know, we either have to think about finding an alternative home for the child, or we really, really try our best to work with the parents so that they can kind of come around to feeling like they can cope.
Yeah.
And that their kid can cope as well.
Yeah. Do you find you get better results when the parents are involved?
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I suppose they need to be involved in the right way.
Yeah. Yeah. In some ways, you know, if the person is maybe 17 or 18 and their whole life has been a battle with their parents, we might help them to individuate. So it could be that we think they might actually be better off, you know, not going back to their parents. But
yeah.
I think that's quite rare.
Okay.
Yeah.
How soon do you start seeing improvement with the adolescents that you work with?
I think it's very individual.
Yeah.
So it really depends on, I guess, how unwell someone is, and also the supports that they already have in place. So if they do have a really strong family support, you know, that might be really integral to them getting back on track or feeling better. Sometimes they come to us in a real crisis situation. For example, they've just become homeless, and, you know, hence become really hopeless and suicidal. And then it's kind of about helping them to see other avenues and, you know, things that are worth living. And that can sometimes take a bit longer. And I guess with people who have psychiatric illnesses such as psychosis, it's really dependent on how unwell they've been previously, maybe how they got unwell. So it could be if it's like a drug-induced psychosis, then it resolves a lot quicker than an organic kind of psychosis. It just depends.
What are some insights that you've gained from working in this particular role?
I guess it's really underlined how important those early years are. So I think I took for granted that I had a good childhood, and it was normal for me to be happy when I was a kid.
Yeah.
But seeing all these kids who have just gone through these terrible things and how it's affected them. It's been really powerful, and I think it just shows how much, you know, when we're young and developing, it is important for us to be nurtured and cared for. And if we're not, then it kind of impacts us for the rest of our lives.
Yeah. Do you think you'll stay working with adolescents for a while, or like, do you think you found your avenue, or are you thinking of moving on soon?
I really miss forensics. I do miss forensics. Maybe I can combine them and work with young adolescents who have offended or maybe lost their way a little bit. But I'm happy at the moment, so I think I'll stay for a while and then maybe reassess.
Yeah. And this question is mainly for me. What is some advice that you can give to someone who's engaging in psychology studies?
In terms of the study, it is a long road.
Yeah.
So there's undergrad, which is nothing like what the job is, and I don't think it prepares you at all.
Really?
So don't be put off. I guess a lot of it's very general, you know, theoretical stuff, statistics.
But do you think that stuff's a necessity or you just don't really use it?
Look, I think it would be better if undergrad was a bit more geared towards what it really is like to be a psychologist, and there were more practical tasks and opportunities for practicing some skills. I think going into fourth year, which is honours, and then fifth year, I was just astounded that I just had this moment where I was like, I've never actually talked to anyone and tried out any of these counsel or done any of that, and it just feels so late to be kind of trying that. So I think maybe some good advice maybe might be that while you're in undergrad, you could try and do things like volunteer. Lifeline is a really great place to volunteer. Again, pretty confronting, but I think, you know, you'll start building on those skills and understanding what it's really like, and then you can then decide whether it is something that you want to do.
Yeah. So what is it really like then?
I think it's confronting. on a day-to-day basis.
But emotional. Surely that's expected.
Yeah, but I think you don't know until you do it, I guess.
Yeah.
I know a few friends who have gotten into it and kind of decided that it was too much.
And they realise that at the end of...
Yeah, only degree. After working. And it's like, you know, you've done 5-6 years of study only to realise, you know, this isn't my thing. Which is why, yeah, I think it would be good to, while you're studying, to try at least do something similar.
Yeah.
Something to prepare you so you kind of know within yourself whether this is something that you want to do.
Okay. Sound advice. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of Mind Matters on 3CR 855 AM, a one-hour programme about all things psychology. Thanks again to Paulina Marta for coming in to chat to us about her experience working in a prison as a psychologist and with high-risk adolescents. Thank you for tuning in to tonight's episode of Mind Matters on 3CR 855 AM. Join us next Monday from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. for more chats on all things psychology.